Our text for this morning is Psalm 74. Congregation of our Lord Jesus Christ, this psalm is entirely a prayer of Asaph and entirely a prayer of sorrow and lament for the state of the sanctuary of God, the dwelling place of God in Zion, after the destruction of Jerusalem by the army of King Nebuchadnezzar. It's probable, though we can't be certain, that the psalm was written some years after the event, because Asaph begins by asking, "O God, why have you cast us off forever?" Some time, it seems, must have passed for him to make that kind of complaint to God. The reason, of course, for his sorrow is that the destruction of the sanctuary of God in the city of Jerusalem means for the people of God the end of the public service of God in the land. That sanctuary of God that stood in the city of Jerusalem was the place of God's dwelling among them, and the place to which he called his people for their public service to him. It was a place where he revealed his name to them, the place where they offered their sacrifices, celebrated their great feast days and the new moons, and daily offered their sacrifices to God by means of the priesthood. All of that was gone. The temple destroyed, the priesthood killed or taken away into captivity, and the entire public service of God, therefore, in the tabernacle, or in the temple rather, ended by the destruction of God's city and sanctuary. It was, people of God, a time similar to times of great persecution for the people of God in New Testament times, or even like times of great apostasy in the Church of Christ, when there is no pure worship of God offered anywhere, or at least it seems that way sometimes to God's people. Jeremiah also mourns, of course, the loss of the city of Jerusalem and the loss of the temple in the book of Lamentations, throughout that book, really. Let's call attention, though, just to two verses of chapter 2, Lamentations 2, verses 6 and 7. He has done violence to his tabernacle as if it were a garden. He has destroyed his place of assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. The Lord has spurned his altar. He has abandoned his sanctuary. He has given up the walls of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. They have made a noise in the house of the Lord as on the day of a set feast. But of course, it's not only the problem that the sanctuary no longer exists that Asaph is talking about here. The fact that the sanctuary no longer exists means to Asaph that God has cast off his people. Why, O God, have you cast us off forever? Asaph understands and confesses that the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem was due to the sins of God's people, their forsaking him. And as a result of their sins, as a result of their whoredom after other gods, God has cast off his people and made it known to them by destroying the place of his worship. Let's consider the psalm under the theme praying for the restoration of God's sanctuary. First, let's consider, remember your congregation. That is the main petition of verses 1 to 8 of the psalm. It's found in verse 2. Second, let's consider, take your hand out of your bosom. That is the main petition of the second part of the psalm. It's found in verse 11, and that part of the psalm goes through verse 17, 9 to 17. And then finally, let's consider, remember that the enemy has reproached. That's verses 18 to 23. We consider, first of all, then, that first petition and what's associated with it in verses 1 to 8. Remember your congregation. Now, the complaint with which Asaph begins this psalm, people of God, sounds, at least at first glance, as if Asaph does not understand why God has cast them off. Oh God, why have you cast us off forever? It seems almost to be a denial of Israel's sins rather than a confession of sin. But I think what we have to understand here, people of God, is that Asaph is primarily concerned not with the fact of God's judgment, but rather with its length. O God, why have you cast us off forever? It seems to him that God has abandoned his people for good. And this idea of forever continues throughout the psalm, in all of his petitions and in all of his prayer to God. In fact, the word that we find here in verse 1 occurs three more times in the psalm. You find it, first of all, in verse 3. Lift up your feet, to the perpetual desolations. The perpetual desolation, same word that we find in verse 1. Notice that you see it again in verse 10. Will the enemy blaspheme your name forever? And finally, again in verse 19, do not forget the life of your poor forever. Asaph is concerned then particularly with the length of God's judgments. In fact, it comes up again in verses 9 and 10, nor is there any among us who knows how long, O God, how long will the adversary reproach? He does not mean to deny then that Israel has sinned, but he rather questions that God has forsaken his people for so long a time. Is it going to be forever? This would be, Asaph reminds God, a very remarkable and strange thing, because Israel is not like the nations around. God's anger smokes against those nations forever, and justly against those nations forever. But Israel is different. Israel is the sheep of his pasture. Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? And that metaphor, of course, calls to mind all the tenderness, all the love, all the care that God has bestowed on his flock over the many hundreds of years since he first called Israel to be his people. And Asaph is here pressing God strongly through his petitions to return to his people, to show again that love and care for his flock which he had showed in his past, to restore again, really, ultimately, the sanctuary among them so that they may know him and worship him again as they have in the past. Remember, he says in verse 2, your congregation, which you have purchased of old. Notice again how he focuses on what God has done for his congregation in the past. He purchased it of old. Undoubtedly, that's a reference to the redemption of Israel out of Egypt. Israel was purchased out of Egypt by the blood of the Passover lamb and by the power of God's arm. God had made Israel his inheritance, his special treasure among all the nations. He had become their inheritance. They had also become his inheritance, the tribe of your inheritance, which you redeemed. And God had set up his dwelling place in Mount Zion, the temple, which is now, of course, at this time, destroyed and gone. Remember, he says, all that you have done for your people in the past, all that they have been to you, they have been your congregation, your sheep, your inheritance, your Mount Zion, where you dwelt. The second petition that he makes here in this first part of the psalm is found in verse 3. Lift up your feet to the perpetual desolations. I think, people of God, that what he is asking God to do there is to walk through the ruins of the sanctuary. Go and observe, he says, what the enemy has done. And be stirred up by the cruelty and severity and wickedness of the enemy to restore what they have destroyed. He describes then all that the enemy has done in the rest of that section, verses 3 to 8. The enemy has damaged everything in the sanctuary. I think that word damaged is probably a little too weak a translation of the Hebrew here. It might better be translated, the enemy has wrecked everything in the sanctuary. They've taken the furnishings away. They have hacked down the carvings, as we'll see in a moment. They have knocked down the walls, and they have set fire to the remnants so that nothing is left. Your enemies roar in the midst of your meeting place. You can get the picture, I think. He's carrying us back to the time when the enemies, the soldiers of Nebuchadnezzar's army, actually entered that holy place, the place where God dwelt, and defiled it by their simple presence there, entering into the holy place, first of all, where not even God's people could go, only the priests could go, and entering ultimately even into the most holy place, where no one could go except for the high priest himself. And there in that tabernacle, not to worship God or to reverence his majesty, but to roar. That is, to roar with triumph, to shout with laughter, to make fun of all that the Israelites have tried to do and of their worship of God there. They are roaring there with their wickedness in the midst of God's sanctuary. They set up their banners for signs, or the Hebrew, to be literal, they set up their signs for signs, suggesting, of course, that they have torn down the signs that Israel had been commanded to place there by God and have replaced them with their own banners or with their own signs. Those signs are probably the standards of the army, or perhaps even, it might be, the signs associated with the worship of their God, whatever that was, their altars or whatever it might be that was associated with their God. They have come into the sanctuary then to set up there not the standards of the God of Israel and of the armies of Israel, but the standards of an ungodly nation. They seem like men who lift up axes among the thick trees. They're like loggers going into a forest to clear cut, destroy everything in sight, lifting their axes and hammers against the sanctuary of God. They cut down, they break down its carved work all at once with axes and hammers. That's a reference, people of God, to the fact that there was a great deal of very skillful carving in the sanctuary of God. You read about it in 1 Kings 6, verse 29. Then he carved all the walls of the temple all around, both the inner and outer sanctuaries, with carved figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. All of that carved work then, remember the temple was built of stone, and then the inside was covered with cedar wood from the cedars of Lebanon. All of that wood was carved with figures and then covered with gold. Well, these enemies come in there and they break down all that carved work, probably to get at whatever gold may remain at this time, but also simply for the purpose of destruction. They hate this sanctuary and they hate the people of God who worship there. They have set fire to your sanctuary. They have defiled the dwelling place of your name to the ground. Nothing is left. But also, people of God, they are not satisfied with simply destroying the worship of God at the temple in Jerusalem. Verse 8 shows us that they extend their destruction of the worship of God to the whole land. They said in their hearts, "Let us destroy them altogether." I think "them" refers to the meeting places of the next line. They have burned up all the meeting places of God in the land. Now you'll hear, of course, from some modern scholars that there were no synagogues in the land of Israel prior to the return from the captivity in Babylon. It was especially in Babylon, they say, that the people began, because of the destruction of the people, to worship in the synagogues and establish this as an alternative place of meeting with God. But that cannot be the case, because God commanded in Leviticus chapter 23, verse 3, that the people have weekly convocations. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work on it. It is the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. We don't hear about that word synagogue prior to the return from the captivity in Babylon, but certainly the people of God were meeting on a weekly basis in their towns and villages throughout the land to worship God. They were required to go to the temple only 3 times a year, but they were required to worship God every week in the meeting places. And so this army of Nebuchadnezzar, in order that they may wipe out the worship of Yahweh, has gone throughout the land, destroying all those meeting places of God that stand throughout the land. They want to suppress entirely the worship of God among his people. And God is doing nothing. God has cast off his people. God is silent. God takes no action against these enemies who are defiling his sanctuary and who are persecuting his people. He lets it continue, and he lets it continue year after year after year. O God, why have you cast us off forever? The second part of the psalm then focuses on that petition that we find in verse 11, "Take your hand out of your bosom and destroy them." But let's notice that he begins again here with complaints. "We do not see our signs." In light of the fact that this word has already been used in verse 4, they set up their banners for signs. That word "signs," I think, refers in the first place to all those signs that were part of the temple and of the worship of God there in the temple. It refers to the Ark of the Covenant, to the altar of incense, to the table of showbread, to the candlestick or to the lampstand, to the altar of burnt offering, to all that carved work that had been destroyed. That was symbolic too, to the veil and the curtains and everything, even to the priesthood and the sacrifices. All these were signs that God had established to show his people his covenant, his dwelling among them. And they're all gone. Everything has been destroyed. But I think it refers also, I don't think we have to limit it to that, I think it refers also to those signs that were evident in God's mighty works for his people. Those are also called signs in the Old Testament. And God's mighty works on behalf of his people have also ceased. Nothing is being done in their defense. Nothing is there anymore of the worship of God, but nothing is being done either to preserve or defend them against their enemies. All the signs of God's presence among them are gone. Gone forever, it seems. Not only that, but there is no spoken word of God anymore. There is no longer any prophet. God has silenced the voice of the prophets. Jeremiah was the last one, and he was there, of course, at the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, and even after for some time. But it must be that at the time this psalm was written, Jeremiah was no longer there either. He had been forcibly removed from the land of Israel by some of the wicked men who remained in the land after the captivity. And there was no prophet anymore to speak to the people. God's voice also had fallen silent. And so there was no one there to explain to them the judgments of God or how long that judgment would last. Nor is there any among us who knows how long. You might say, well, why did they not recall what Jeremiah himself had prophesied in Jeremiah 25, verses 11 and 12? And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then it will come to pass when 70 years are completed that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, the land of the Chaldeans, for their iniquity, says the Lord. And I will make it a perpetual desolation. That prophecy was probably forgotten. The people of Israel and Babylon didn't remember it either. They also did not know how long. It was Daniel, we read in the latter part of his prophecy, who discovered that prophecy of Jeremiah and based a prayer to God upon it. No one knows how long. And so Asaph turns to God and he says to God directly, how long? How long, O God, will the adversary reproach? How long are you going to let this go on? We need to know. We need to know that there will be an end someday. We need to know that you do intend to come back, to restore your worship, to make yourself known again among us. Are you going to let the enemy reproach you and blaspheme your name forever? Now he's not talking anymore about the state of God's people, is he? He's talking about what these enemies are doing against God himself. Regardless of what they may be doing to your people and the state of your people, are you going to let your name be dishonored indefinitely? Have you no concern for the glory of your name, that glory of your name of which you said you were so jealous? What they have done to the sanctuary and to your people is not just a reproach to us, it is a reproach to you, O God. Do not let them blaspheme forever. And yet what we see is you standing by, as it were, with your hand tucked into your bosom, at ease and inactive, observing what the enemy is doing, but not reacting to it. Take your hand out of your bosom and destroy. Take your hand out of your bosom and destroy. In order then to encourage himself that God will answer his petition, Asaph begins to recall God's works in the past in verses 12 to 17. He recalls, first of all, God's works for Israel. One of the things we should notice about these verses, people of God, is that the word you that appears so often in those verses, 13 and following, is emphasized very strongly in the Hebrew. Perhaps you know that in some languages, Hebrew included, if the pronoun that is the subject of the sentence is the subject there, that pronoun does not have to be specifically expressed. It's contained instead in the form of the verb. Spanish has this too, and many other languages. We don't have it in English, but many languages do. So you don't have to express that pronoun explicitly because it's contained in the form of the verb. But if you want to emphasize it, then you put it in. And that's what the psalmist has done almost in every sentence here in verses 13 and following. He's added the pronoun to the verb so that there's a very powerful emphasis on that word "you" throughout. You divided the sea. You broke the heads of the sea serpents. You broke the heads of Leviathan, and so on. It's you have done all these things in the past. It's all that you have done that the psalmist is recalling here. And he recalls, as we've already pointed out, first of all, what he has done for his people. God is my king from of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. That's a very striking statement, isn't it? Here is Asaph standing in the city of Jerusalem among the ruins of the sanctuary. The people of God are in captivity. The monarchy of David is gone. And he recalls the kingship of God. Israel has been returned to that pre-monarchic time of the period of the judges, when there was no king in Israel and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And you can read about it in Jeremiah if you want to. Every man did what was right in his own eyes, and he says, God is my king from of old. Working salvation in the midst of the earth. He recalls all God's mighty rule over his people and all the works of salvation he had done for his people in the past. And he begins to recite them then in verses 13, 14, and 15. You divided the sea by your strength. That's the division of the Red Sea so that Israel could pass through on dry ground. You broke the heads of the sea serpents in the waters. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. I have a note in my Bible at home, people of God, about that section, those three lines. They say this: in the next few verses, the poet alludes to a popular concept of creation and applies it to the Lord. What they're referring to there is that in the creation of the world, God, some of the pagan nations around had myths about God contending with sea monsters and leviathans to bring order out of the chaos that existed at that time. And they're saying, this is what the psalmist is talking about here, these sea monsters. In using these figures, the psalmist is not endorsing the popular myths, but using them to say that the God of Israel is the creator of all. I don't think that's at all the reference here. I think the sea monster and the Leviathan are Egypt. And what he's talking about is the destruction of Pharaoh's army in the Red Sea. You broke the heads of the sea serpents. He destroyed the chief and choice men of Egypt there in the sea. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. After the sea had come back and drowned Pharaoh's army, the bodies of the Egyptian soldiers undoubtedly washed up on the shores of the sea and became food for the animals who inhabited that area of the wilderness. People there refers then not to men, but rather to animals. You can find such references to animals as peoples in Proverbs 30, verses 25 and 26. The ants are a small people or something like that in Proverbs 30, verse 25. A people not strong. Then you broke open the fountain in the flood. That's a reference to the breaking open of the rocks so that waters could come forth from the rocks to give drink to his people. And finally, you dried up mighty rivers. He dried up the Jordan so that his people could pass over. So he's recalling all those works of God from the time of Israel's leaving Egypt to her entrance in the land of Canaan, those mighty works of God. And he's saying, see, these are the evidences that God is my king from of old. This is what he has always done for his people. Then he goes back even farther to the days of creation in verses 16 and 17. The day is yours, the night also is yours. They belong to him. He created them. He governs them. He maintains them. He does with them as he wills. He changes them if he wants to, as he did in the days of Joshua and in the days of Hezekiah. You have prepared the light and the sun. That's a somewhat unusual expression, isn't it? Usually we'd read about the sun and the moon, but here I think the psalmist wants to remind us that the light and the sun are two separate creatures of God. He created the light first, and then he created the sun to bear light, to send it on the earth. You have set all the borders of the earth. I think we can take borders there in the broadest possible sense. It refers to the boundary, for example, that God set up between the earth and the sea to keep the sea from coming back to cover the land. You read about that in Proverbs 8, verse 29. This is just one example. When he assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters would not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth. But it may also refer to the boundary between heaven and earth itself. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 7, we read this. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so, and God called the firmament heaven. It may refer to the division of light from darkness. Genesis 1, verse 4, God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. It may refer even to the boundaries of the nations. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8. In the words of Moses to God's people just before his death, Deuteronomy 32, verse 8. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. All this is his work. All this establishment of boundaries in all these different places and in all these different ways, God has done. It's evidence of his great power. And finally, there is the fact that he made summer and winter. He established the seasons. Probably not at the time of creation, but rather at the time of the flood. We read about it in Genesis 8, verse 22, where God promises that summer and winter will not cease until the earth itself ceases. All this, then, God has done. And Asaph is appealing to all these mighty works of God in the past to say, God can do such works also today. I know it. He is my king from of old. And then finally, in the last part of the psalm, the main petition is found at the very beginning. Remember this, that the enemy has reproached, O Lord. And the psalmist here carries on with petition after petition throughout this section. We're going to have to talk briefly about each of them. But first of all, he appeals, notice, to the jealousy of God. We've already referred to that. Remember this, that the enemy has reproached, O Lord, and that a foolish people has blasphemed your name. And he returns to that same theme again in 22 and 23. Remember how the foolish man reproaches you daily. Do not forget the voice of your enemies, the tumult of those who rise up against you increases continually. Let God's jealousy be roused, his jealousy for his own glory, and let him take action against these wicked men for that reason, if for no other. In verse 19, he appeals to the love of God for his people. Oh, do not deliver the life or soul of your turtle dove to the wild beast. That turtle dove is a term of affection for the people of God. In verse 19b, he refers to the pity of God. Do not forget the life of your poor forever. And then in verse 22, his promises. Have respect to the covenant. For the dark places of the earth are full of the haunts of cruelty. Probably that's a reference to the disorder and wickedness that reigned in the land of Israel after government was wiped out by Nebuchadnezzar. So he, in every possible way, grounds his petition in what God has been and has done for his people. He makes no appeal, notice, throughout here to what God's people have done. Does not plead any righteousness or any merit or any worth on their part. It's all what God has been to them. The life of your turtle dove, the life of your poor, your covenant. Remember and defend your glory. Remember the love you have had for your people. Pity them in their sorrowful state. And remember your promises. Come back. Restore us. Not for what we are, but for what you are and have been. Do not let the oppressed return ashamed. Do not let our hopes be disappointed. But rather let the poor and needy praise your name forever. This is, then, ultimately, in the mind of the psalmist, a contest, not between Israel and the army of Nebuchadnezzar, but a contest between God and the army of Nebuchadnezzar. O God, plead your own cause. This is not my cause, he says. This is your cause. This is not the cause of your people. First, this is your cause. Come back. This is the cause of your glory. This is the cause of your love. This is the cause of your promises. Is all this going to be forgotten? Are you really going to change towards your people to such an extent that we must suffer forever in this way? So it's a psalm first then, people of God, of passion for the glory of God. Remember that the enemy has reproached, O Lord, and that a foolish people has blasphemed your name. It's a psalm of great love for God's people. Remember your congregation. It's a psalm of delight, fervent delight in the house of God. Remember what David says in Psalm 26. Lord, I have loved the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. And it's a psalm then also of hatred for all those who work against that glory of God and the well-being of his people. Take your hand out of your bosom and destroy. It's a psalm of grief over the state of the church. It's a psalm, nevertheless, that embraces the power of God to deliver that church. There is no resolution in this psalm. There's no great change from despair to hope, from doubt to faith, from sorrow to rejoicing, or any such thing. The tone of the psalm remains the same throughout. And it is a psalm that is sorrowful, primarily. But it's also a psalm that does not lack confidence that God can and will do for his people what he has done for them in the past. that he will indeed plead his cause and restore his sanctuary. May God bless the proclamation of his word.